Thank you for downloading the Dunkcast, featuring some of the best bits from City Talk Breakfast with Duncan Barks.
Hello, it's Duncan here, and thank you very much for taking the time to download the Dunkcast, or the Dunkcast, featuring some of the bits that we've been up to recently on the City Talk 105.9 Breakfast Show. You can always contact me about anything you like. My email address is Duncan, D-U-N-C-A-N, Duncan at citytalk.fm. During the week, what do we get up to? Well, we spoke to Chris Davis. He's a Northwest MEP. Maybe you voted for him at the last European elections. He's chucking his hat in the ring to become president of the EU. In a slightly tongue-in-cheek campaign. Find out more in a few moments' time. You're also going to hear from Dr. Eric Sigmund. He's a psychologist. He believes that kids have got ASBOs. Well, it's not their fault. It's all the fault of their parents. Have a listen to his logic. Find out what he had to say a little bit later on as our podcast continues. Then, of course, we talk about smoking. And in Liverpool, during the week, it was the final day of a public consultation that was launched by Liverpool City Council, because Liverpool PCT and Smoke Free Liverpool genuinely believe that new films that feature smoking scenes should carry 18 certificates. Now, I think this is the biggest load of balls I've ever heard. Someone who agrees with me is Paula Keaveney. She's a Liberal Democrat councillor here in Liverpool. Find out what she has to say about this suggestion. Also, we talk hunger and hunger strikes with Gary Skiner. Gary's someone who we've been following on City Talk Breakfast over the last 3 weeks. He's halfway, or he was halfway, through week three of his hunger strike to get greater compensation for victims of thalidomide. And you can hear what he had to say when I spoke to him on City Talk Breakfast during the week. And finally, it wouldn't be the Dunkcast, or indeed the Dunkcast, unless we had a Dunkin's Donut. Picture this for a second. Newquay Brown. You know, the bottles you see behind the bars and in the fridge cabinets in pubs? Newquay Brown Ale. A staple of life for almost a century. Can you imagine Newcastle Brown Ale being made somewhere else apart from Newcastle? It's going to happen. It was the subject of Dunkin's Donut, and you can find out more. Thank you very much for downloading the Dunkcast, or indeed the Dunkcast. We'll speak soon.
City Talk Breakfast with Duncan Barks. City Talk 105.9.
So, we might end up with a president of the EU, and I've seen Tony Blair over the last couple of weeks kind of being suggested that the gig is his. And I don't like it when that kind of thing happens, because you lose your faith in democracy and politics, and you read stories about Blair's former chief of staff, Jonathan Powell, making trips to Brussels and Strasbourg and trying to shore up support from his former boss to be the new president of the EU. As someone who's launched a campaign, well, kind of, is Northwest MEP Chris Davis. He'd like to have a go, and he's on the line. Morning, Chris.
Good morning, Duncan.
So is this a serious campaign?
Well, I don't see why not. I mean, I've looked at the other candidates who seem to be in the running for this job of president of the European Council, which is the gathering of the prime ministers. And I think I fit the bill. I'm white. I'm male. I'm middle class, I'm middle-aged, I've been to a good university, I've got a few years of political experience. I mean, what more do you need?
Just run through, because there'll be people listening this morning across Northwest England and North Wales who'll be thinking, well, who are these other candidates? What can you tell us?
Well, most of them are ex-prime ministers, about my age. We all came in together. We all, if you actually look at our job descriptions, I think we all seem to have come off the same production line. What's missing from a selection contest which could involve up to 500 million European citizens is almost any mention of a woman, or anyone really, is a bit different. You might be able to relate to citizens in a rather different way.
People listening this morning who might not be too familiar with the background, will this role be fully elected?
It'll be elected by the prime ministers.
Yeah.
This is a job that's been described as the president of Europe. It's, and to some extent it will be, because this will be the prime minister's spokesman, if you like, the prime minister's president. The European Council is the grand name for the summit that takes place every 3 months of prime ministers and presidents and chancellors from across Europe, and some people would say this job is really just their chairman. But the Lisbon Treaty, if it's ratified, says that its job is to take their work forward. Now, who knows what that means? I mean, it could mean just write the agenda for the next meeting, or it could mean, you know, you're up there, centre stage, leading and speaking on behalf of the entire European Union.
A lot of speculation that this is a done deal for former Prime Minister Tony Blair. Do you reckon it's a done deal for Blair?
I think it's only a done deal in the British press. I think there's a good deal of opposition from a number of member states, not least Belgium and Netherlands and Luxembourg. I mean, Tony Blair is a fantastic communicator. I've seen him speak to the European Parliament and swing round a very hostile audience in the past. But you can't get away from the fact that many people believe he has blood on his hands. Many people believe that he took the country, the UK, into a war on very dubious grounds that led to the death of hundreds of thousands of innocent people. There are people here who would say he doesn't belong in Brussels. He belongs in The Hague before the International Criminal Court. It's very difficult to say, you know, we've got Obama now, the Bush years are behind us over in America, but we want Blair? No, don't think so.
You've gone on the record to say European citizens should be told whether this is just a beauty contest for middle-aged males or a professional recruitment exercise intended to select the best person for the job, someone with ideas about how to shape Europe's future. How should Europe be shaped in the future?
Well, there's two ways of doing this. First of all, you either get the Prime Minister to say exactly what sort of person they want. Do they want a real leader for themselves, or do they want simply a secretary? Or you invite some of the candidates to present their own credentials. Now, personally, I would say that if I were to get the job as last man standing, then there are things that I think this person should do where we're failing. We sign up to the great principles of liberty and freedom and, you know, the rule of law, and yet prime ministers, when they're gathered around the table together, don't like pointing the finger at each other and say, but you're not living up to these. They don't point the finger at Berlusconi and say, where's the freedom of the press in Italy? They don't point the finger at Romania and say, Why are minorities, the Roma, still being oppressed in this way? But one way or another, you know, you need that person to say, Europe stands for more than simply trade. It stands for values, and you know, we've got to live up to those.
One of the things that made me smile, Chris, about your letter to the heads of government is your PS, which reads, I should point out that my first executive position was to chair Liverpool City Council's Housing Committee at a time in the 1980s when the opposition was dominated by Trotskyite members of the militant tendency. I do not anticipate that chairing meetings of Europe's heads of government will prove any more difficult. Do you think your experience here in Liverpool is going to put you in a good position to deal with the rough and tumble of Brussels?
Well, I think Derek Hatton was more than a match for Berlusconi. Would have been then, would be now. I think a political background in Liverpool politics has benefited many statesmen over the years. I think it's done me a lot of good.
My final question is the whole issue of Europe, Chris. I mean, we have various political parties, Lib Dems included, who have said, you know, getting into government, we would do a referendum or whatever. We had the Tories and David Cameron saying that if they're in government and the treaty is not ratified, they will put the whole question of Europe to a vote of the British people. Do you think people in the UK really want to be part of the EU?
First of all, I've never been in favour of a referendum on anything other than the issue of whether we should be in Europe or not. You can't have a referendum on a detailed treaty which just involves 250 mostly incredibly minor changes, because no one's read the thing. I've read it, but I don't expect my constituents to have read it. That's why you elect people to take decisions. And every single parliament in Europe, every single elected parliament, every single government says we need the Lisbon Treaty to make sure that a Europe with now 27 nations can move forward. Should we be in the European Union? Well, that depends very much on whether you want Britain to be playing a significant part in world affairs and controlling our own destiny. If you don't want Europe, if you don't want Britain to be in Europe, then just understand that most of the big decisions will be taken by the nations of continental Europe and will be outside the meeting room where all the decisions are taken. It would leave us weaker than we are now by a long, long way.
City Talk Breakfast with Duncan Barnes.
The lady sitting opposite me in my City Talk studio is Labour's Riverside MP Louise Elmer.
Somebody who came to see me about their asylum claim got pretty upset and went out of my office door and doused themselves in petrol and sat on the floor with a lighter held close to their clothes, so that's not something I'm used to happening.
You managed to get the lighter or the matches off them in order to ensure their future safety?
Yes, I did that. I managed to persuade the gentleman concerned to hand me his lighter. And of course, it could have put other lives in danger as well as his own. So a very upsetting incident.
City Talk Breakfast with Duncan Barks.
Now, we've all heard about children, teenagers who get ASBOs. And there is a line of thinking to suggest that even for some children, these things don't work because they're almost like a badge of honour. But who is to blame? Who is responsible for a child and their behaviour that results in them being given an antisocial behaviour disorder? Well, let's get a thought on this. Dr. Arik Sigmund is a research psychologist and he joins me this morning. Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning.
Good to talk to you. Thank you for your time this morning. Sure. Pushover parents to blame for ASBO kids. You're calling for more common sense and less red tape. Before we look at your calls in detail, how did you reach your conclusion? Why are pushover parents to blame for kids who have got ASBOs?
Right, they're not solely to blame, of course, but looking at adult authority, particularly parental authority, a lot of parents don't want to exert any authority. They don't really enforce boundaries for their children. They don't say no, and they don't mean it, and they don't have consequences and punishments when their children defy those boundaries. That is one of the main problems. But if you look at what I call the extended parents in a child's life, the other figures of authority, you're talking about teachers, policemen, doctors, nurses, neighbors, all of us as adults have had our powers eroded by governments, successive governments, not just this one. Many of us are really relatively powerless legally to deal with young people and children nowadays for fear of being charged with assault. For example, in the last couple of weeks, a 71-year-old disabled woman was found guilty of assault for prodding a 17-year-old boy. They had been throwing stones at her house and swearing at her. Last week, a 62-year-old teacher, when a boy 15 years old in his class kept telling racist jokes and he refused to stop and wouldn't leave the classroom, the teacher walked down the aisle, grabbed him by the scruff of the neck and the band of the trousers and hauled him out. He was found guilty of assault. So you can see it isn't just what goes on in the home, it's all of the extended parents. We don't have joined up parenting anymore.
Some people will say that legislation is in place to actually protect children.
It was intended. One of the main points of my book is to say, with the best of intentions, the tail is now wagging the dog, and it's been counterproductive. These protective measures have not worked the way that we thought. They've actually harmed children by preventing parents and other adults from doing what's necessary to help shape our children's behavior and make them more socialized.
You're calling for more common sense and less red tape. Just outline your thoughts on that in a bit more detail for me.
Right. From now on, when our governments, whoever they happen to be, frame laws, there should be an absolute presumption, both in law and in policy, that we adults know better and that we're in the right unless there are exceptional reasons. And what this means in practice, which means that dealing with children may actually entail touching them and even manhandling them. Tough. This is what we've got to do now. We have a real problem on our hands. And it's also a question of giving the police and teachers, doctors and other figures of authority the ability to really do their jobs without having to look over their shoulders to the extent that they're doing now. This isn't to say that the police should be taking advantage of people, being rude and brutal to people. Of course not. But it also means that there are times when they need to do their job and they shouldn't have to worry about stopping people, searching people, asking questions. That's what they do in all the other countries I've visited. But here, I think liberal middle-class guilt has gotten in the way and prevented a lot of professionals from doing their job.
I think I agree with most of what you're saying, but I come back to my initial question, Doctor, which is this. You know, we only know, sadly, too well from recent news headlines regarding people who are supposed to be criminally checked and looking after children in nursery schools in Plymouth, that some adults, given this responsibility, given these powers, simply cannot be trusted. Surely we need something in place to protect children who have been the victims of these people.
Well, certainly the issue of paedophilia is quite a different issue from what I've written my book about.
Sure.
And interestingly, when they started to do checks on these people, it had no effect. They abused the children anyway.
Let's take paedophilia out of the equation and let's look at the fact that we do sadly do have adults who, given these powers, if you like, do abuse them. They do still exist. There might be a fraction of society in the population, but they're still out there. So how do you still protect those children?
We have always had laws. So, for example, there is a great pressures in this country. Most European countries now have outlawed even slapping your child on the wrist when they reach for a hot burner on a cooker. Now, in this country, they're going in that direction. The fact of the matter is we have always known the difference between a parent who punches their child in the face, slaps their child in the face, and the parent who slaps their child on the wrist. The idea that we need such specific laws to tell us parents what we can't do in many ways undermines our authority. It sends a message to all children, you can't and we don't trust your parents to know the difference between a slap on the wrist and a punch in the face. That's the kind of legislation that really needs to be dealt away with. And there are many other examples that I can give as well. For example, in family law, we know that we have the highest rate of fatherlessness in Europe. Yep. And we know that fatherlessness is strongly linked to all the social problems that you're talking about, particularly ASBOs. There's a very powerful link between ASBOs and not having a father around the house, especially if you're a boy. Now, when you look at the ability of fathers, thanks to the Children Act and the Family Law Act in this country, it is extremely difficult for a separated father to see his child if the mother makes it difficult. It's one of the most difficult countries in the world for a father to achieve that. And listeners now know that if they don't pay to support their children, the Child Support Agency, free of charge, will chase them and make them pay. But there's no child contact agency which will enable a father to call if he needs help to see his child. And certainly, if middle-class fathers have the money, they might be able to hire private, expensive lawyers. But most ordinary working guys can't do it, and there isn't a government agency which will step in and enable them to parent with authority to help bring up our children in a way which will keep them away from social problems.
City Talk Breakfast with Duncan
Barnes. Travel Lodge, but they've done this survey and they've asked Britons the places, the cities they most wanted to visit before dying. In between Edinburgh, number one, and Liverpool at number three, Bath. My God, it's boring. What's his musical heritage? Peter Gabriel, it wasn't that good. He got replaced by Phil Collins in Genesis. And guess what? Tears for Fears. I mean, the music of Tears for Fears totally sums up what Bath is all about. Bland. Yet we have the Beatles. Tears for Fears beats the Beatles. You're having a joke, aren't you?
City Talk Breakfast with Duncan Barks. The show that isn't afraid to say what you're thinking. The best of Barks. City Talk 105.9.
Today marks the closing date of the public consultation the Liverpool City Council have set up because the PCT, Smoke Free Liverpool, came along to them and said, we want you to give 18 ratings and certificates to smoking seen in new films. And what's happened is the council have put this out to public consultation. We've had you on this show before because you're opposed to this idea.
Certainly, yes.
For people who have not heard your reasons why, just outline them again.
Well, I think it's a step too far. I supported the ban on smoking in enclosed public places because mm-hmm. that's like, I go in, someone else smokes, I breathe in their smoke, I get ill. So that to me is an issue of liberty. This to me is an issue of liberty as well, and it's about artistic freedom and not censoring things. But also, I don't think this would work. How many people are influenced purely by what they see in a cinema? Most of us see things on the street, we see television, we go on the internet, and young people do much more of that than they do sitting in cinemas. And I just think this wouldn't work anyway. So I'm against it in principle, but I'm also against it because it wouldn't work.
When you talk to other councillors about this particular issue, what are their views on it? Are they broadly supportive or broadly against?
Well, they're mixed. I've talked to quite a few people who are against for the sort of reasons that I am, but I have found a couple who are in favour for reasons of wanting to prevent people dying of cancer. And my response to them is, well, this wouldn't do that. All it would do is force people to go across the borders to another authority to watch the film. And it wouldn't achieve any of the things the PCT wants to achieve. But what it would achieve is a restriction on our liberty and the liberty of artistic people who create the films we want to watch.
Have you taken part in the public consultation?
I haven't, because I may well have to vote if this comes to the City Council for a vote, and I don't want to be ruled out of order for voting on a technicality, so I'm protecting my position, as it were. But that doesn't mean I'm not encouraging
sure.
everybody else to send those responses.
I did it this morning.
Good.
And literally it takes
Good.
5 minutes. I was saying earlier, there's only so many times you can use the word guff and rubbish and ridiculous and absurd in one public consultation set of answers. Do you think it will come to a vote?
I very much hope not, actually. I don't think it will. I think there would have to be a huge swelling of opinion in favour of it for it to be worth the effort of going through a committee and then going to the council.
Right.
However, I haven't seen the volume of responses, and neither should I, because I'm not entitled to privileged information the same as anybody else. So I don't know what volume's coming in. My guess is that it won't get as far as a vote, though.
OK, and it wouldn't... So just so we have some understanding this morning, it wouldn't become a vote if the majority of people in the consultation said no. Is that
well,
right?
If the consultation was heavily weighted towards no, I think the technicality is the licensing committee would still have to discuss that, but it would be very difficult, wouldn't it, to push ahead to a full vote if the weight of the evidence was that it wasn't supported.
And what's your gut feeling on this? Do you think it will go through? Do you think smoke-free Liverpool will get their way?
My gut feeling is no, they won't. But it's a gut feeling. It's not based on any hard evidence. And I have actually criticised them for not bringing hard evidence. So I will give a little caveat there for that statement.
The best of Barks. City Talk 105.9.
Gary is a victim of thalidomide and he went on hunger strike just over 3 weeks ago in order to raise awareness of victims and to get increased compensation for victims of thalidomide. And he joins me on the line. Morning, Gary.
Good morning, Doug. How are you?
I'm very well indeed. More importantly, how are you?
Not good, mate. Just it's getting worse now. It's I'm knackered all the time, and you know, I'm isolated, mate. I can't believe that we've been left the way we have. You must be a mind reader. We've had a letter of social services. The Department of Health have contacted them and said to them, you've got to, basically a damage limitation exercise in case anything happens to me while I'm on the strike, you know.
Let's just recap and refresh people's memories this morning, Gary. What day did you actually start the hunger strike?
21st of September, Monday.
Okay, and you're taking vitamin pills and liquids, but that's it, correct?
Yeah, it's a thing called Monoviti, and it's like it gives you the equivalent of your 5 a day.
Yeah.
And apparently the Red Sox over in America, they use the drink as a supplement to actually give them vitamins before they play a game.
And your mum's still on hunger strike with you?
No, mate, she came off last Monday. She wasn't very well at all, and thankfully she's called it a day because, obviously the last thing we want to do is lose her, and she's seen sense in the end. But I'm sticking with it, mate, for what it's worth. Nobody's took any notice, thanks to City Talk. You're the only media outlet, really, that have given us the airtime and bothered to follow the campaign.
Well, I've got a couple of ideas regarding that, and we'll look at that, and I'll discuss that with you in more detail in a few moments' time. If you don't mind me saying, for someone who's been on hunger strike since the 21st of September, you're still sounding quite chipper.
Yeah, it's a case of having to keep your pecker up, mate. What can you do? You know, I mean, I was 22 stone 4 when I started it, and I'm now 20 stone 8. I mean, I wasn't the slimmest of lads. I mean, some of the jokes we've had off the lads who know me, that, you know, you've got 8 years to live, and it's really, the problem I've got is that I've got an enlarged left ventricle, and any change of the pattern that you have with your kidneys can have a knock-on effect with your blood pressure, which again can affect your heart. So, you know, we know that it's going to be a long time before the weight loss comes in. But, I mean, I wanted to lose weight. Anyway, I was losing it.
Yeah, but Gary, you didn't do this to lose weight and shed a couple of stone. You did this to send a very clear message out to the government of the United Kingdom, agreed?
Say again, though.
You didn't do this to lose weight and shed a few stone. You did this to send a very clear message to the government of the United Kingdom. And apart from a visit from a local MP, it seems to me very few people people who are able to make any decisions and help you in your fight have actually bothered to take any interest.
Absolutely right, mate. Yeah, we had a press conference in London last week, and what you would say, the quality media turned up, the Financial Times and the Independent, so they've gone with two big middle page spreads on it. It hasn't got national ITN, it hasn't got national BBC, BBC Northwest are following it, you're following it. It's just that we're not emotive anymore, we're not bundles of fun, we're not jumping down on people's knees. What I can't understand is that everybody listening to your programme now, who pops a pill this morning for blood pressure or whatever, can do so in the knowledge that, because of our disaster, that every single safety net is in place now because of what happened to us. And we are the guinea pigs, and how the government could say they're not responsible for their GPs giving my mum a drug that they said was safe, and I ended up coming out with, you know, deformed arms and people worse off with no arms and no legs. How they can say they've got no involvement, that it's beyond me.
The thought that must be uppermost in your mind, Gary, is the fact that, well, it's a question, does anyone care? I mean, you mentioned the media outlets such as City Talk and various other news programmes keeping abreast of your campaign. But if I was in your shoes, I would be feeling this massive sense of frustration that people from the Department of Health or a government health minister haven't really taken on board exactly what you're doing and why.
Yeah, it just shows you that. I mean, the main crux of my argument is, Duncan, is that if America sneezes, we get a cold. In 1958, America was shown the same evidence as we were, and they wouldn't allow the drug onto their shores. Now, that would have exposed the potential 300 million childbearing women of childbearing age to a drug that was fatal. There was no way it was getting onto their shores. This Frances Kelsey woman from the FDNA in America refused it a licence, and yet we gave it one.
One of the things we're going to look at doing over the next couple of days, Gary, is we're going to contact the Department of Health and see if we can get a health minister on this show, same time as you, to see if we can get a conversation and a dialogue going.
You know what, Duncan, that would be fantastic. I mean, I know it's another media outlet, but there's BBC, the programme, the documentary Inside Out, they're doing a film at the moment, and Ricky Tomlinson, as you know, was on GMTV with me, and what we're planning to do is to actually try and get a meeting with Andy Burnham face-to-face, but if you can do that with City Talk, mate, either Andy Burnham or a junior minister even, to find out why they're not listening, that would be fantastic. This shows you how good City Talk is.
In a world full of bungling bureaucrats, power-crazed politicians, jumped-up pen pushers, and the plain old stupid, one man fights a lone battle for sanity, armed with a sword of vitriol and a shield of common sense. Duncan Barks takes on the Pillocks the only way he can, by awarding them the title of Duncan's Donut.
I'm a sad man this morning, not because of that piece of music that I heard earlier that just makes you reflect on certain moments in your life, but I'm a sad man because a great institution looks like it's coming to an end. The product will still be made, but not where it's been made at the moment, and I think something needs to be done about this. Let me explain. At some stage in our lives, myself included, you'll have partaken of several bottles of Newcastle Brown Ale. I remember when I was doing my early stages of drinking, 18, 19 years of age, in one of my local pubs, you always had a bottle of Newquay Brown in your hand, because that's what people drank at the time. I can't touch it now, because typically, one night, I had too many bottles of Newquay Brown, and I can't even smell it anymore. For decades, it's held the same reputation in Newcastle as champagne in France. But yesterday, it was revealed that Newcastle's world-famous brown ale is to leave the town. Newquay Brown being made somewhere else apart from Newcastle, it's true. The announcement's been made by Brewers Scottish in Newcastle, marks the end of 82 years of tradition. The decision, which will also mean the loss of 63 jobs, was branded as a disgrace. A disgrace is the mildest word I can think of at the moment. From next year, production will move to the John Smith Brewery in Tadcaster, in North Yorkshire. You can't have Newquay Brown made in North Yorkshire. It's currently made at the Federation Brewery in Dunstan in Gateshead after production was switched from Newcastle 4 years ago. Bosses at the brewery blamed the economic downturn for the decision and insisted every effort will be made to seek alternative employment for the affected workers. Well, quite right, show. But the point is this. It is called Newcastle Brown Ale. Gateshead you can just about get away with. You can't carry on calling it Newquay Brown. It was going to be made in North Yorkshire. It's not on. You got to rethink this decision. Think about this for a second. Newquay Brown is one of the greatest drinks to come out of Great Britain. It's got to remain in Newcastle. Well, I've only got one thing to say to you lot of bosses. At the brewery, Scottish in Newcastle, you lot, grade A 100% donuts.
Dunkin's Donuts.
Find out more about City Talk Breakfast with Duncan Barks at citytalk.fm. We hope you've enjoyed the Dunk Cast. If you have, please download again next week.